Oh, this is for all of us. Yeah. Should be more. Oh, this is the handouts for the talk.
Can everybody please point down, and then I'll go ahead and introduce our speaker. I know it's hard. Yeah. We all have wonderful things to say. Okay. We'll have more time after our business meeting. We have quite a bit of free time this time, so you're going to have lots more time to chat with them. Today, we're really fortunate to have Dr. Gary Tregidja here from Cornwall. He is the Assistant Director of the Institute of Cornish Studies at the University of Exeter at the Cornwall campus. And he's the Director of the Cornish Audiovisual Archive. And he's going to be speaking to us about our opportunities to study Cornish history online. Of course, it's wonderful if you can go there, but it's great that we have opportunities to learn more right here in the United States.
Context for what I'm going to say today, context for the talk today, actually goes back to 1904. You might say, why do I go back to 1904? It goes back to a gentleman called Bevan Black Zuma. Now, it doesn't sound very much like a Cornish surname, that Zuma, and in fact it wasn't. Black Zuma was a Polish priest who was born just across the border in Devonport, but became the vicar, Anglican vicar of Newland. Many of you know David Burr, just in Penzance area, essentially. He's been tended to be forgotten now, but back in the late 19th century, it was the Reverend Black Zuma, along with the more famous Henry Jenner, the founder, it's been argued, of the Cornish Revival, the Celtic Cornish Revival, who gathered the fragments of the Cornish language. Now, Reverend Black Zuma in 1904 declared that what Cornwall needed was a university. It needed to copy the example of their Welsh cousins and establish a university. Now, his dream still hasn't quite been fulfilled, but in 2004, the Tremoe campus was opened jointly by the University of Exeter, which I work, and the University College Falmouth, which is situated also on that campus. And they came together to form the combined universities of in Cornwall, which it's been argued in due course will become a Cornish university. So that's the context for what I'm going to talk about today, certainly this morning, because it's within that framework in recent years that there has been an expansion of educational facilities, educational courses in Cornwall, with the potential of more to come. I've divided my little talk really in three sections, looking at the current education provision. We have had MA, a Master's in Cornish Studies, and I'll say more about that a little bit later. Certainly since around about 1999 period, really. We've also been an opportunity through the Institute of Cornish Studies, and I don't know if many people know about the Institute of Cornish Studies, I know some of you do, Gage in particular. The Institute of Cornish Studies was established back in the early 1970s by the University of Exeter and the then Cornwall County Council to provide a focus for education in Cornwall, and even then the plan was that it would become the nucleus of a future university. So we have provided MPhil courses, what would be, I don't know what the equivalent would be in the US, but sort of like a Master of Philosophy, and PhD as well. So those courses have been continuing for some time. More recently, we've been actually able to develop our undergraduate provision in Cornwall. So it is possible to essentially do a BA in, say, History and Cornish Studies. We haven't quite got a BA in Cornish Studies, but there's a BA in History in Cornish Studies, or maybe a BA in English Literature in Cornish Studies. So from the age of 18, it's possible to actually study straight through on the subject relating to Cornwall. Now, if I say a little bit, first of all, in more detail about the master's course, because that, in particular, has got a strong distance learning provision. We've had students studying that since around about 1999, not just in Cornwall, not just in the UK, but in places around the world. We've had some Australian students. We've had students from the US as well. And basically just explain how that module essentially works. It's divided into a series of modules. One is entitled Exploring Cornwall. And that goes through the various different aspects of what Cornishness is, what Cornish identity is, both historically and contemporary as well. When I say historically, we tend to actually go back to 1497 through this particular course. And 1497, as some of you no doubt are aware, was a time when the Cornish rose in rebellion against the English state. It was a rebellion fueled, as usually is the case, over taxation. Henry VII decided to go to war against Scotland, basically. And the custom up until that time was that if you lived in a border area of Britain, whether that was on the English-Scottish border or on the English-Welsh border, the people on that border area would actually fund that war. It wouldn't be people in other parts of the English state. Similarly, too, if you lived around the coast and you were attacked by foreigners, by maybe sort of like pirates or whatever, it would be the coastal areas which would be responsible for their own defence. Henry VII introduced this new taxation, which fell particularly on the Cornish. And I don't know if anybody has come across the Cornish Stannary Parliament at all. Do you know about the Cornish Stannary Parliament? Some of you.
Yeah, I've heard we've got a resource of looking information up.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, just explain to those who don't know. Cornish Stannary Parliament was, its origins have essentially been lost in the mists of time. But certainly it had developed in the Middle Ages to be a separate parliament for Cornwall, separate, that is, for the tin miners. So the tin miners had a right of veto, basically, of any legislation which went through the Westminster Parliament. And there were various charters which were actually brought in to being by the English state, simply because Cornish tin industry was of vital importance to the English Crown. Basically, if it wasn't for Cornish tin, King Charles I would have been unable to actually fight this English Civil War. The money came in from Cornwall. So as a result, Cornwall, having its own Duchy of Cornwall, its own Stannary Parliament, had this sort of like semi-autonomous identity which existed. Now, going back to 1497, the year before, in 1496, King Henry VII decided to suspend that Cornish Stannary Parliament. So the poor Cornish, not only did they have to pay taxes to fight a war up in Scotland, they also lost their own parliament. So naturally they rebelled. I'm using this as an example because just to show some of the things which actually are taught on the course, both in terms of exploring where Cornish identity has come from in the past, and where it has developed through the ages. Researching Cornwall is basically, you can apply different ways of doing it. Using history to actually study Cornwall in different historical disciplinary approaches. Political science, anthropology, literary studies, all those different disciplinary areas are actually introduced on this researching Cornwall module. Cornish history also looks at some of those constitutional issues. What apparently made Cornwall distinctive in the past? What about the situation at the present? You know, so it's quite a broad course covering the full spectrum. What about mining? How did mining develop in Cornwall from its very early days through to its decline in the 19th century? it's collapsed. It's been argued that in the early 1800s, the late 18th century and the early 1800s, Cornwall was at the forefront of the British Industrial Revolution, the major players. But obviously, as we've heard already from Gage, mining collapsed. New sources were actually discovered around the world, made it more economical for that tin, copper, or whatever to be actually worked overseas. And what were the knock-on impacts for Cornwall? To a situation where by 1897, there were just a handful of mines still operating in Cornwall. And that basically was the pattern through to the late 1990s when Cornwall's last tin mine disappeared. Though it's a story which doesn't totally disappear because there are people now still trying to actually save Sir Crofty, and there's a potential that it could be opened up in the future. So that becomes an important part of the course as well. And the other side is, of course, the Cornish overseas, the Great Diaspora. That's one of the courses that we actually teach on the Cornish history. How did people move overseas? What were the motivations? Obviously, principally, you've got the economic side, which actually encourages, forces people to actually leave Cornwall. Interestingly enough, those people who first tended to leave Cornwall, certainly in the early 1800s, there's obviously people who migrated before, going back to 1700 and moved over to the USA, but certainly in the early 1800s, many of the people who actually left were farmers. They came from North Cornwall. They were, many of them were Bible Christians. I don't know if that term means anything to people. Branch of, obviously, an important branch of Methodism. Now, some would argue that Bible Christians are not British Methodists. But they're the closest that Cornwall actually has come to its own type of Methodism. And I'll say a little bit more about that later on this evening. But many of those Bible Christian Methodists living in places like North Cornwall moved to the USA in search of jobs, yes, but also because they wanted to avoid having to pay a tenth of their income to the Anglican Church, which of course they didn't belong to. So looking for political and religious freedom, America was the land of opportunity. And then obviously the situation whereby the collapse of mining in Cornwall necessitated a move to actually survive in the long term. So many of those things are actually taught. There's another module I put down there as well, which is Cornish communities. Now, Cornish communities module is one that is taught by myself, and some of you may have come across the name of one of my colleagues, Bernard Deacon. Bernard has done a lot of work in terms of migration, along with one of my colleagues, Philip Payton. I'm sure you know, yeah, because he came last year, wasn't it, I think? What I do on this course, however, is to approach the idea of community. Now, whether that's community in Cornwall or Cornish community like Grass Valley. And we combine different approaches. Bernard's course is to study census data, a quantitative approach, using statistics to actually trace developments over time. I'm director of the Cornish Audiovisual Archive, which is essentially an oral history and film-based archive. But we do a lot of work in terms of cultural memory, stories which are actually passed down through time. And obviously, if you look at Cornish communities in the USA, it's something which we are quite keen on actually finding more about as well. Oral history isn't just about our own lifetime, but stories we may have passed, picked up through our own childhood, maybe unconsciously, of previous generations. And that cultural memory has nonetheless shaped us as individuals. And if we look at the wider scheme, through collective cultural memory, ourselves as part of the wider community. So that is basically a rundown of some of the MA Cornish studies. And as I said, it's a distance learning module. It can be done. We have our students, and at present, the majority of our students actually on the course are doing it on a face-to-face, come along to a day school, that sort of basis. But we've had quite a large number of students before who've actually studied for this course from overseas, using bulletin boards, using the internet as a power, and as a way of actually finding out more about the actual course. We also, however, do a dissertation course. That's where you, the student, would actually write 20,000 words, essentially on a subject of your own choice, but relating in some way to Cornwall. I was talking to Gage yesterday. I think it was Susie Buttrick. I don't know if that name means anything to anybody, but I think a few years ago, she actually was living in California for a little while and actually did some work relating to the Cornish in California. So in that case, that provided a really interesting subject. So a growing number of dissertations covers quite a broad spectrum, from Cornish in the USA, Cornish in Australia, to particular places in Cornwall like Penzance and Padstow, to particular themes, Cornish politics, Cornish religion, quite a broadly spaced course. But one of the things that I'm actually personally developing now is to sort of like open up the opportunities for distance learning so that it can be approached in different ways. Education isn't just about doing courses like Masters or PhD or whatever, important though obviously that is, but we're quite keen to develop the sort of like lifetime education approach so that there are other opportunities for people, both in Cornwall and throughout the Cornish world, to take a greater interest, to participate in a program which we've actually entitled Cornish Story. Now, has everybody got a copy of this? I've got a few more here if you want. You'll see a number of websites down there, and one such website is one that exists called cornishstory.com. Now, at present, we put up there a few of the audiovisual interviews that myself, my colleagues in the Cornish Audiovisual Archive, which is a unit of the Institute, have actually been doing over the past year. But we are planning to actually open up that website in quite a wide variety of ways. This month, we are actually launching an online magazine called Cornish Story. And it's going to come out on a quarterly basis. The summer issue brings together a number of the sort of like projects and a number of topics relating to Cornwall. The next issue coming out in the autumn is going to be about a project that I'm involved with at the Institute, which looks at Cornish farming traditions and the importance of that for looking at a sense of Cornish identity. And through this online magazine, we're actually open to actually hear from people in the Cornish world overseas, so that you too can actually participate, put forward your articles, etc. So that's one side of what we're actually doing. But we are quite keen to develop an oral history and film programme of different Cornish communities around the world. I mean, I was really interested last night when everybody was actually sharing their testimonies, their personal reasons for actually joining California Cornish Cousins, along with your own ancestral links, or even if there's no ancestral links through the naturalisation ceremony, people actually come to be associated with your organisation. Now that's one of the things that we're trying out over in New Jersey. Actually, it's been contacted by Margaret Kahn of the equivalent Cornish Association in New Jersey, who's actually developing an oral history programme, getting members of the group to actually record their own stories, and the aim is to actually put a lot of that up on this Cornish Story website so that you can simply put the material up there. We will provide a sort of like a program, because obviously in today's day's world, you can't just go and record stories, you know, you've got to have the right copyright forms, consent forms, right way of going about it, so we can actually provide the paperwork and information on actually doing that. So if members of your group would be interested in doing that, you know, talk to me at the weekend. I'm delighted to talk to you about that, because that's one of the key things that we are quite keen on actually doing. But there are other dimensions to this as well. About 2 years ago, I was contacted by a Cornish descendant. This girl, she was a student based up in Michigan. Now, her tutor was at that stage, I think, the president of the American Welsh Studies Association, I think they call themselves. And she wanted to actually come back to Cornwall, the land of her own land, to actually do a summer school. But there were no courses. She, in fact, had to go to Cardiff because there were American Welsh summer schools taking place in Cardiff. And similarly, there were a number of other Irish and Scottish summer schools being held in Edinburgh, Dublin, wherever. So, along with my colleagues at the Institute of Cornish Studies and through this Cornish Story programme, we're quite keen to actually do something similar. So, in other words, you can actually study virtual learning, but if you so wish, we can link that to actual summer schools, which can be held back in Cornwall. We've got this new Tremoe campus, which is actually based on the site of another medieval building, medieval site. And there was a manor house there in the 17th century. It's a very nice place to actually study. And that's one of the key things that we're keen to do, is to actually open up the opportunities for summer schools for students who may be studying in American universities to actually come back to Cornwall and during that period find out more about Cornwall. But also open it up to everybody who would be interested in doing a combination of distance learning, that you're in a position to do so, to come back and partake in a summer school. I've put down there an example of something that we're planning to do for next year. Migration from Cornwall, obviously, is a very complex process. You do find, however, certain families moving from, say, West Penwith, or the Clay Country, or the South East Cornwall area, notably the Tamar Valley, moving to particular spots in the USA, Australia, South Africa, wherever. So in association with an organisation called the Tamar Valley Area of Expanding Natural Beauty, we're planning to actually put on a summer school, which is going to be held at the late medieval manor. I don't know if anybody's ever been there, Coteel. It's a really lovely, you've been there. Yeah, it's really beautiful. Right down by the Tamar River, just in Cornwall. Really, really lovely place. And looking at a whole range of subjects like family history. The families actually may have moved from the Tamar Valley overseas. Looking at the archaeology of that area. And the archaeology of the Tamar Valley is very interesting. It's not just the sort of medieval, early modern archaeology, or earlier than that. But as mining developed in the early 19th century, there were many families in West Cornwall who actually moved eastwards. Places, if you go historically back to the so-called late Dark Ages, as Anglo-Saxon incursion came gradually down through what became the Anglo-Saxon Kingdom of Wessex, Somerset and Devon, the East Cornwall area became more anglicised. But by the 1800s, it started to be in reverse. You started to see many families from West Cornwall moving eastwards in search of work, search of opportunities, settling in South East Cornwall and going across the border into Devon. In fact, so much so that you started to see in Devon towns like Tavistock, little Cornwalls emerging. This was a period just before many people started to move overseas to places like the USA. So as a result, you get many Cornish families moving from West Cornwall to East Cornwall, and then as mining collapsed in East Cornwall, moving to the USA. So combine that too with looking at the unique folk culture, so like customs, the musical traditions of the area, and again, looking at migration patterns, the Tamar Valley Area of Expanding Natural Beauty, I'll use their initials, AONB, that's what they refer to themselves, are quite keen to make connections with organisations throughout the Cornish world to try to actually trace those migration patterns, try to actually make those connections. And that's one of our partner organisations, but we're also working with the Royal Cornwall Museum, which is based in Truro. Now, as I was talking to Gage over the past couple of days, this is Cornwall's principal museum. and they're very keen to actually develop a diaspora program so that we will work with Cornish associations around the world to develop a website, to perhaps actually take artifacts, which or copies of artifacts, photographs, etc., from Cornish groups such as yourself, for that to become part of a permanent exhibition over in Cornwall. And at the same time, to try to establish a sort of like an exchange between, say, community colleges in the USA and community colleges back in Cornwall, who would develop getting young people, getting students to actually take photographs, to video, etc., and maybe create some sort of exchange of students going from Cornwall, coming over to the USA, and vice versa, students from the USA coming over to Cornwall. Now, doing that in one gigantic step would be actually too much, so we are on the lookout for developing a pilot project, and where better to start with, if you're interested, than the California Cornish Cousins. That way you find ways of actually involving young people who can actually have exchange with young people back in Cornwall and develop connections and links there. Linked up to what we're doing as well is that we're developing that educational process. As I said earlier, there already exist opportunities through master's degrees, MPhil, and PhD routes. But we're quite keen to develop opportunities, qualifications for people at a variety of levels. So, for example, we can create certificates and diplomas in Cornish history, which can be provided through online study, linked up to these summer school programs, and can be taken basically over a variety of ways. Using the power of the internet and using face-to-face delivery of education are just for those series of opportunities. So you can develop a series of tailor-made courses designed for you, the individual. You can develop it at the serious level. You can develop it at a sort of more of a fun level, so that it can enhance family history research. But at the same time, you can actually gain great enjoyment by actually providing that wider Cornish context. So, well over 100 years now since that Zuma actually called for a Cornish university, the need to actually sustain that educational interest in Cornwall, the opportunities are finally starting to happen. I'll invite some questions in a minute, but just briefly, continuing on with the website theme. Like I said, we've established cornishstory.com, which is going to be the principal means of delivery for online courses. For those people on Facebook, we also have got a Facebook site for Cornish Story as well. Cornish Audiovisual Archive, like I said, is a research unit based at the Institute of Cornish Studies and is actually pushing and developing many of these opportunities to broaden the opportunity to actually create new routes, new avenues. We can also be found on what is entitled carveracanstudies.org. Cornish Audiovisual Archive, or Carver for short, we're not the wine, despite the fact there's similarities, but we were established 10 years ago, so 10th anniversary in fact, this year, as a partnership between the Institute of Cornish Studies and a whole range of community bodies. Many of you perhaps who have done family research in the past in Cornwall, we've gone to places like the Cornwall Record Office, Cornish Studies Library at Redruth. They are our partners in this organisation. We've worked quite closely with the National Trust, now with University College Falmouth, and we're open to encourage an interest in Cornwall and Cornish studies in schools in Cornwall. So that, you know, it's possible, basically, from the nursery to the grade, to develop that interest in Cornwall. And through our work, in terms of oral history, principally, and film, we're creating new multimedia ways, which can be complementing written texts, traditional routes of actually doing study on Cornwall. So there's more information on that particular site. Now, the bottom website, very long title, but that's a very long address actually, but that is the full address if you click on there, would give you more opportunities to find out exactly how the MA in Cornish Studies operates, you know, what would be expected. I've given you a brief rundown on the four principal modules and also the dissertation route. So there's more information on how other students have actually experienced this particular course. So that's it for me on that discussion. Have you got any questions?
Is this website supposed to have links where there's...
There's an underscore. And you know, I'll put these on the Yahoo group. I'll link them all on our Cornish Cousins Yahoo group and send that out as an email too.
Because there is a danger that if you have too much problems if you total anarchy. And one thing that we've got to be very careful is that all material that goes up there has got to have a sort of like a single consent form, so that the person being interviewed obviously has given their consent, and that can be simply the choices from the UK. But looking at this stage, if you were to do something like tomorrow, we could actually put it up there for you, and then in the next couple of years, it would be totally open up with that proviso that we will accept their consent.
And you can set up, conceivably set up one person or, you know, the go-to person
exactly.
For a project for this group.
Definitely, we'll have to support them. And I mean, the aim is to create a global network of researchers. And obviously working with other organisations. I mentioned the webinars, the family material that we've started to put out there already. We developed that project with the Portland Family History Society so that it becomes a genuine partnership. And, you know, by working together, we can actually achieve a lot more.
It was recently contacted by a woman, maybe Angela Keith, with a project in Cornwall called Singing. The children were singing, they were looking for photographs from around the world, of course, families and mining communities or choirs.
Or I've heard of that one.
Yes, and I had some pictures from all the down of the Harrys, not necessarily of singing, but there were boys marching band, and they were very interested in pictures of the mining community itself. So I just wondered, here's this, they're doing this project on the vocals. I just wondered if that was connected to
them. We haven't gotten a specific connection with them, but you know, it's a logical route that we would go down. There's, I don't know if anybody has come across a site which is called SCRAC. Now, I think that stands for Scottish Cultural Access Research Network, which, and I think they call themselves scran.ac.uk. And we would like to develop this Cornish story program in a similar sort of way, but perhaps learn from their experience, do things a little bit differently. You know what I mean? Because we want to open up the site. I mean, with the SCRAN site, certain things are free and other things are restricted. What we want to do is say, right, this material has got to be out there in the public arena. So as long as it's done properly in partnership with other organisations, we would aim to actually open it up. And other material, for example, we've been offered a lot of film material recently. Of the Alston Ferry back in 1953. And that material, later this year, we're going to put on a memory evening, which is a similar sort of thing that we were doing last night, a memory evening, basically. So we can go down there and invite people to come along. Cornish Audiovisual Archive, we've got very much a young team, actually. A publicity officer is 21. We've got two field work officers who are 24, and they're actually really keen to actually get involved in and find out more about their Cornish identity and Cornish heritage. And a publicity officer comes from Elston, has danced in Elston Ferry since she was DI, as they say. She's going to organise this memory day for us to actually invite people along who were living there and performed there back in the 1950s. So we're taking a silent film, about 40 minutes in length, and create a soundtrack of people's story. So that sort of thing can actually be seen on the story website. And if we use this, but combine it with material from the Cornish overseas, through the old photographs, if there's any sort of like new video material or any old cine film, you can see the opportunities that can actually be found.
I was wondering if the program. How, do you know how many people in the States are going through it now or have completed it?
Currently, we haven't got any students from the USA, but we have had probably, my guess would be 4 or 5 students with the past 10 years.
Okay. Are they in certain areas of the Midwest?
We've got one student who was actually doing it over in near Florida. It's fairly quite dispersed, you know. But it's actually something that we would like to actually create new opportunities for, because we started this distance learning option 10 years ago, before, you know, Cornwall campus actually existed. And in fact, there are now new distance learning opportunities starting to emerge, and there is a new program for our school, for college. The Institute of College Studies is from August on, it's going to be part of the College of Humanities. And we're looking to try and actually develop.
Could you tell us a little more about that program, Gary, as far as what a typical student, if there is such a thing anymore, what a typical student's experience is, whether it's self-paced, how long it takes a typical student to go through the four modules, and how much it costs.
Okay, so the course itself is fairly flexible, so that's one thing to consider. It means that, on average, you know, students would take 2 years to complete. Some students, however, may want to do, say, a particular module 1 year, not do another one, then do, say, two the following year, or something like that. So you could be looking at a situation, if you're doing it on that basis, of maybe, I don't know, 5 to 6 years. But the normal sort of average route would probably be 2 years. Now, the price, obviously, that is the other thing. It is quite expensive, you know, £2,000 per module, which is the other thing. I mean, I don't know if that would work out in terms of US dollars, but quite a lot of money.
Right now, about $3,000.
About $3,000 a module,
So it's quite an expensive course. I shouldn't talk like this, either my employers, but the university is actually in danger of pricing itself ahead of the market, really. That's the danger. It's partly reflecting a general thing, which is going through British universities, and no doubt the same in US universities. Cutbacks in terms of government funding, so that creates some of the problem. But you can also, if you didn't want to do the full master's program, you could do maybe, I think, sort of like three modules at least, and you receive a diploma in higher education, which is sort of like certificates and diploma groups that we're looking about next year are actually going to be a lot cheaper. You know, not reflecting, it's also reflecting the fact that obviously it's not at a master's level, but we've got greater flexibility by actually working with our partners in University College Farmer to, you know, ensure that it's actually going to be cheaper groups and functions. Any other
That's very good. Thank you.
Okay.
How's your Canadian response been?
Canadian response. Now, I haven't personally managed that much links there, but our Celtic link partners, who I mentioned, as I said, they're based in Cornwall and developing some strong connections for us. They're trying to develop links, and they're quite keen to do so with Nova Scotia, actually, and it's at the Centre for Celtic Studies up in Nova Scotia, and try to basically create new opportunities in other places as well. But that's one area where we would like to actually expand it, because, as I said, we've got opportunities to work in New Jersey. I've got the potential of using stuff in Colorado, but we haven't actually developed that strong community base, and that's why, in a sense, I'm looking to help.
But as far as students from Canada?
Well, students from Canada. Yeah, let's tell them. I have an approach, as I mentioned, Michigan and various other places. But no, not from Canada. Not today.
Is there a strong Cornish?
Yeah. Is it particular Toronto Cornish Association?
Just, well, there is. But, I mean, it was actually east of Toronto.
East of Toronto.
Oshawa and Whitby. Yeah, is where they were all settled.
Summer school, and you know, we could provide accommodation for Yeah. We're quite keen to actually work with partners on the ground. The Hayward Valley A and B service, our partners over there. I've got three youths that have come to Hill, which is really good, so that's awesome. They've got their own really nice centre at Gunners Lake. I don't know if you can go to Gunners Lake, but there's a little village in Southeast Cornwall, just above Cote Hill. And for many years, I'm interested in what Gage was saying about certain areas like Grass Valley, you know, unemployment being high at one stage and low, certainly, you know, in the 1930s. Gunners Lake had very high unemployment. When the mines collapsed, basically there was very little other income. There was the market gardening industry, which developed in that area. But certainly by the 1940s, the market gardening industry was starting to actually decline. Land was being used during the Second World War, so obviously it could be used the conventional route of the market gardening. It was basically being exploited for that. So that by the 1950s, unemployment in Gunners Lake was like 20%. Really high, a time when Britain itself had very low unemployment in Cornwall itself, 5%. But anyway, Gunners Lake and Cote Hill have been developed in recent years, and it provides a nice environment for the actual program. Possibly over a week to fortnight, I think maybe that's why the fortnight, just to actually see it all developed recently. And any ideas you could feed into me now would be quite useful, because obviously, you know, knowing how you might be interested potentially in doing such a course. And there will be a series of sort of like lectures, other activities being done at Gunners Lake and just down over Cote Hill, with sort of like talks around the area and opportunities. We'd be quite keen to actually bring people from the Easter Society as well, so it would be really nice to support that as well.
So I think if anybody else has questions, invite Gary to lunch or something, and you can follow up. I see you have a lot of free time after our business meeting, and so perhaps you can talk to him then, and fortunately with the internet you can email, and like I said, we'll put all these links on our Yahoo group, and those of you who aren't on our Cornish Cousins Yahoo group, I suggest you join. It's a great way that we can discuss things and share information, and people can send out questions. There's also room there to post